It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome back, or welcome to the first ever Access of Easy salon. This is take two, actually, because we did this last week and we had a really great conversation. It was witty, it was profound, it was mind-altering, and then we only got one stream of sound and we had to trash the whole thing. So we're going to try this again this week and we'll probably all be like off our A game and sounding like twits, but the sound might work. And I have...
Well, the real tragedy is that we solved the pandemic and created a path by which the economy can restart. And then we all went to sleep, forgot what we talked about, and realized the recording was gone.
I know. And there was the cure for cancer, and all of that was in there. Yeah. It's a shame. Pity that. So we have Charles Hugh Smith joining us from Hawaii. We have Jesse Hirsch joining us from his survivalist compound in the Ottawa Valley. And I am breaking quarantine in an undisclosed location in a non-emergency essential workplace close to my house. And where do you guys want to start?
I think it's definitely essential workplace.
Yeah, I guess.
People can't, you know... People can't register domains if people can't, you know, enter a domain and know which IP address it directs to. Society will collapse. So absolutely, I think you underestimate your role in the infrastructure we now depend upon.
Yeah, true. I mean, when the Ontario government put out their list of essential services, it was like we were listed under like internet infrastructure suppliers. So. We were listed several cuts below liquor stores and, you know, something else. But anyway, so, Jesse, what's your point for this week? And then we'll just Jesse, Charles, and I'll quickly say mine. Since I'm talking, I'll say mine's hyper-normalization. I've been writing a little bit about it this week, and I just think that that's the most apt metaphor to describe the kind of world we find ourselves living in these days. Jesse, how about you?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about legitimacy. And, you know, if I think about our conversation that we had last week, which we may or may not remember, and what's changed between now are protests and the extent to which there are more and more people who are frustrated with the state of things, who do not necessarily regard the current public health initiatives or current public health requests as being legit. And, you know, we are on the verge of much stronger action, whether that's automatic contact tracing, whether that's similar kinds of surveillance. And so I've been interested in whether the population has bought in, whether they regard these measures as legitimate, and what needs to be done, why the political leaders, why institutions are not regarded as legitimate, and conversely, why conspiracy theory is flourishing as a result. So it really comes back down to fundamental issues of trust and legitimacy and the way in which this crisis is being managed.
Well, that just dovetails, both of your topics dovetail really nicely with what I've been writing about recently and my topic of the day, which is the way that the status quo now works diligently and ceaselessly to create like simulacra, you know, facsimiles of trust, credibility, transparency, and accountability as substitutes for the real thing that we used to have.
Mm-hmm. Right on.
You know, I never knew what that word was until I read your book, actually, The Status Quo Has Failed, or the one before it, A Radically Beneficial World. And I was like, yeah, that's a great word.
Yeah, and I get criticized for using it too much because it's like one of my favorite words. So now I try to substitute facsimile because people get that, okay? We can call it a simulation, right? I mean, so it's like that, simulation, facsimile of the real thing, yeah.
Well, and it strikes me as very appropriate to our culture in part because we're making very severe political economic decisions based off modeling, based off simulation. And, yeah. You know, where we arguably don't have accurate data, where we're constantly having to adjust, it is remarkable the authority that's been placed in these models and the authorities that have been placed, the authority that's been placed in these simulations. And I think it speaks to the extent to which guessing has become so formalized in our current society that we no longer call it guessing. We call it artificial intelligence or machine learning model. But in fact, it's still just taking a big guess.
That's a great point about the simulations.
Excellent. Yeah.
Charles, you may not know him, but Jesse, you know Jim Carroll, of course, right? So Jim Carroll's a public speaker here in Canada. He's quite notable, and he wrote like the early Canadian internet handbooks back in the mid-90s. But he was messaging me. We were going back and forth yesterday just on iMessage, and I was telling him, I said, Jim, do you remember the Star Trek episode from the very first season where they encountered this civilization that modeled their wars via computer simulations? And then when one of the sides lost, it was like, okay, we have to go report to the incinerator now because we lost the war. And that's how seriously they took the simulation.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. Well, Mark, why don't you explain our other protocol that we're going to use here, which is to each of us is going to refer to an idea that the other participants have presented recently that struck us as, you know, worthy of exploration.
Well, I think he just did. So as Charles just explained, so the loose format of these salons, each one of us comes in each week with a topic of like, here's what I've been thinking about in the last week, here's what I want to talk about. And each one of us also has not necessarily a counterpoint, but a sort of observation or a remark to each of the other participants on what they were talking about. I'm going to, like, Charles, in your case, you know, what I was thinking about what you said this week was a Facebook post you put out, which I don't think you blogged it. I think you just put it on Facebook. I'll quote a little bit of it. The tragic 2009 crash of Air France Flight 447 offers an apt analogy for the global economy and central bank-driven false signals. So you're talking about how the flight entered an area of frigid turbulence over the Atlantic, which caused their airspeed sensors to ice up. A few minutes later, the autopilot disengaged. The co-pilot flying the aircraft overcorrected. What got me was unable to recover, it crashed into the Atlantic, but the co-pilot's last recorded words, "We're gonna crash, this can't be true, but what's happening?" And I believe, I was looking for the date and I couldn't find it, I believe you posted this on or the day before crude oil in the most forward futures month traded negative for the first time in history. And it just really kind of hit me, you know, going 6-8 months back, you started hearing rumblings of this repo market. The Fed had to do these ever escalating interventions into the repo market, and people outside of finance, you know, we didn't really know what this meant. We just knew that maybe something under the hood had come unglued and they were really trying to like stick it back together with spit and twist ties. And then, you know, obviously interest rates coming to zero. We've been here before, but, you know, a lot of people have said negative rates, zero interest rates, they're really not conducive to proper market signaling. And then this, we have this oil trading negative for this energy source that even in a recession, even in an economic depression, we need this to just keep the wheels turning of society, quite literally. And it's trading negative right now. And that, all of that just flooded, you know, when I read this post of yours. So that was my point to you this week.
Yeah, it's like the false signals. And of course, they're falsified on purpose is kind of what we're talking about. But then, as you say, at some point, reality intrudes. Yeah. Go ahead, Mark. Go ahead, Jesse.
I was just going to say, I found the incident of oil prices going negative to be an interesting contrast between how the public perceives these things and how they're actually happening. In that, the way that was presented anecdotally is most people were like, well, why do I have to pay for gas now? Why do I have to pay for my home heating? Is someone going to pay me to drive my car? Is someone going to pay me to heat my home? And that none of this really explained how futures contracts work and the way in which future contracts were really a lot of what was driving this in terms of the glut of supply. And I think that's where, Charles, to your point, that, you know, the way the economy has worked defies logic. And I think as regular people try to wrap their heads around it, they struggle. And maybe the example of oil prices going negative was one of the first real popular signs that things are really messed up to the extent that it defies common sense. And I think that that was the first time in a long time I've seen regular people really question themselves as to what is going on with the economy, and maybe it doesn't fit the narrative that's always been told.
Yeah, and you know, to kind of comment, to tie your two comments together, you know, there's been more than one airline accident that's traced back to the autopilot disengaging or refusing to disengage in the case of the Boeing MAX 737. And so then I think that's another kind of interesting twist, that the machinery of the futures is mostly traded by, you know, computer bots, right? Like all trading. Mm-hmm. And so we have this sort of autopilot that's supposed to keep the markets, you know, liquid and functioning kind of behind the cloak, right? So we don't actually have to understand how it works, but hey, it works. And so that's all we need to know. And it's all like, well, yeah. So then when the autopilot disengages or, you know, refuses to disengage and the whole thing crashes, then we really don't know what's going on because the whole process was a black box.
Mm-hmm. The black box society, both because the governance or our machinations that control the politics and the economy are can't be scrutinized, that people don't understand how it works, but also because, you know, the thumb is on the scale, right? There's always been a certain level of patronage or corruption or a tilting of the way in which the economy is set up to benefit incumbents, to benefit the people who own it all. And I think that's also what is dissolving, that, you know, the emperor is naked in the extent that people, especially in the United States, the way in which a lot of the benefit programs are not going to the people who need it, but instead are going to the airline industry, which quite frankly should be allowed to fail, should be allowed to crumble so that we might reconstruct it or rebuild it based on common sense. And so this is where I keep coming back to legitimacy, that I think the legitimacy of a broken economy, the legitimacy of a broken society is waning rapidly. And I think it's making it difficult either for this public health crisis to be managed, but it may also make it difficult for the economy to come back online in a way that doesn't represent the needs of everyone, or in the way that doesn't at least acknowledge the needs of everyone.
This was one of the things that we talked about last week, that you know, success in the sort of established order wasn't about being a wizened expert that had this wisdom to guide society, but it was being a seasoned veteran of Byzantine back alleys of the system itself, and how to navigate that is what spelled success in the system. And then what you were describing now, this crisis in legitimacy, it comes down to an economic term that I didn't know until quite recently, but realized I had been writing about it for, you know, 15 years, was the Cantillon effect, right? After Richard Cantillon, who wrote possibly one of the first economic treaties ever, who discovered or said that, you know, money creation is non-neutral, or in our society, credit creation is non-neutral. So when the Fed steps up and they say, we're going to, you know, whatever it takes moments, everyone's going to get bailed out, there's going to be paycheck protection, all of this stuff, very little of that actually still makes it down to the street. And most of it makes it to, like we said, the airlines, right? And I think we did touch on the point last week that the airline industry spent $47 billion on share buybacks over the last 10 years, and they're asking for a $50 billion bailout. And they'll probably get it.
You know, Mark, you brought up the point that I was going to, my point of that your recent posting about the fact that the elites that are running the black box, they're actually only good at navigating the the matrix of the system that allows them to control everything, they're not actually good at solving the problems which are facing us. And so their expertise is in managing the matrix, not in actually solving real world problems. And I thought that was really critical, because we're being told, oh, this guy's an expert, you know, he has all these diplomas and he has all this experience, and yet they're really only good at managing their career within the matrix, not actually solving real world problems. And that's part of the simulation, you know, that we're talking about here. And then Jesse, you know, you spoke, and this was already a number of weeks ago, but it's still something I think is just critically underappreciated, which is you wrote about the potential for meaningful relationships and friendships through the internet, through to people that we've never physically met. Mm-hmm. And I thought the point that I thought was so interesting about this was, number one, nobody seems to talk about that. It's like, it's kind of like shooting fish in a barrel to say that Facebook and Twitter and all this social media is superficial and meaningless and time sink, all of which is true. But I think the sort of under the layer, under the surface, what you're talking about is most of these relationships, at least in my life, which are meaningful with my internet friends, are through email, which is not a platform, which is not being edited, you know, by you know, the platform.
Well, it's the difference between a platform and a protocol.
I just wrote exactly that. Platforms versus you know, protocols. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, and why we should be thinking about that kind of infrastructure, because, you know, Charles, a concept that you've been writing a lot about lately is the notion of a brittle economy or a brittle society. And that really has influenced my thinking lately, because I almost feel that brittle as a metaphor really speaks to the problems that we're dealing with. Because I think what you were just describing in terms of Elise, in terms of experts and decision making, is that their logic is brittle. Is that they've been trained to work in what you're accurately describing as a simulation. They've been trained to work in a very narrow and complex system that's now broken and obsolete, and they really don't know how to adapt. In contrast, and I read a fascinating article that set up this juxtaposition, in contrast, say, to the average person or a tradesperson, right? If you're a carpenter, if you're a plumber, if you're an electrician, you don't have the option of saying, hey, I don't know how to handle this particular job site, or I don't know how to handle this particular design, or I don't know how to handle this particular problem in terms of a building deteriorating or in terms of something that needs to be fixed. No, you got to figure it out. You got to use your past experience and your past wisdom to try to find some kind of fix, to find some type of solution. And that's how most of the world works. That's how most people approach their jobs. So when they look at institutional leaders, when they look at experts, and they see them not able to adapt, not able to deal with the different socioeconomic or sociopolitical conditions that this pandemic has created, I think that's where the legitimacy falls down. That we're expected to be resilient, but our leaders and our institutions are not. And yet they're still in power. And yet they're still trying to claim the authority that they presently have. And that, to me, sort of speaks that our notion of a brittle economy is not just about policies or institutions. It's also about skill sets and mentality. And I almost feel that the mentality of the elite, the mentality of the experts currently running our society, rigid and very brittle. And I think that's part of the kind of the emperor's naked effect, that everyone can see that and they're kind of disappointed with the responses that we're currently seeing.
Yeah, well, Mark, why don't you tie that into hyper normalization, which is was a new concept to me until I saw Adam Curtis's documentary, which you you referenced in your writings.
Yeah, I mean, so I actually started rewatching that this week because I've been thinking about it, and while I don't entirely agree with sort of the way Adam Curtis views the role of government in all this, like he sort of almost portrays government as this hapless victim of, you know, unbridled corporate interests. And like his description of cyberspace, right? Like William Gibson cyberspace, he said, there's only ruthless corporate power with no government to protect you. And I'm like, And maybe this is part of the whole crisis in legitimacy that Jesse's talking about and you're talking about, is I have this sense of, when has the government ever been there to protect any of us? Like, to me, I subscribe to, I mean, you know my background, that you know, I sort of lean libertarian. So the Murray Rothbard government is, you know, a racket. It's just a bunch of people who've seized control of the reins of power to sort of run things at their to their benefit at everybody else's expense. But what I also did is I dug out my copy of Everything Was Forever Until It Was No More, right? That Adam Curtis based the hypernormalization of. And it was written by Alexei Yurchak at the end of the Soviet Empire. And what just blew me away is just like on the very first page, it had never even occurred to me that in the Soviet Union anything could ever change, let alone disappear. It was not until around 1986 and 87, when reforms of perestroika were already afoot, that the possibility of the socialist system not lasting forever even entered his mind. Of course, it had less than 2 years left to live at that point. The Soviet system's permanence and immutability and the complete unexpectedness of its collapse. And despite the seeming abruptness of the collapse, this is an important point, they found themselves were prepared for it, a peculiar paradox. Although the system's collapse had been unimaginable before it began, it appeared unsurprising when it happened. And that really feels like where we are right now, with the possible contrast is that the catalyzing event during the fall of the Soviet Union was perestroika. It was like the opening up and sort of the relaxing of social controls. You know, cost Gorbachev his job, but he's basically renowned as a leader who made tough decisions and things that had to happen, and it led to the downfall of the Soviet Union. Today, we're going in the opposite direction. We're ratcheting up social control. We're clamping down on social freedoms. And so, but I think it's the same kind of dynamic that people believe this is just a crisis. We'll get through it. So there'll be, you know, there's this tug of war between people who sense that there's never going to be a return to normalcy. Like, January is gone. It's never coming back. And people who think that, you know, they can't imagine the system that we live in not surviving this crisis. Like, they can't even wrap their head around it. And so to me, the hyper-normalization aspect of all this is everyone, our leaders, our policymakers, even corporate incumbents and big tech, they're treating this like, if they acknowledge that this is a game changer, they're acknowledging it to their benefit. It's like, oh, we might have to never let you go outside again. But they're still doing it within the framework of, but we're still going to be in charge, and the system's still going to be structured as it is, and we're still going to be, you know, okay, and you guys are still going to listen and follow all of our orders. And there's no conception of the possibility that, you know, what happens with the election in the U.S. in November could be a huge catalyst. Things could come unglued at a very rapid clip, and that we are really in uncharted territory here. And I think it's territory as uncharted as, you know, the months leading up to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Empire. That's kind of where it feels like it is for me.
I think that's a very interesting analogy. And, you know, ironically, I've also been watching a lot of history documentaries about the fall of civilization, because I think it does offer us a similar metaphor. But what strikes me as a relevant contrast to what you're describing is there's no ideology in our current mess, right? All those other systems, you know, might have been like, our ideology is better, or your ideology has failed, and we have better ideas for it, but we're not even having that conversation, right? The people who are currently in power, they don't even necessarily believe with what's happening. To your point, all they believe in is self-preservation, is making sure that they're able to shin. But it's not as if they're saying, we believe that these measures are necessary. I mean, Doug Ford, Donald Trump, even Justin Trudeau, I think they don't actually believe in these measures. They're embracing measures because they don't have any alternative. And I think that makes them even more vulnerable, that there is no ideology, there is no greater vision. It's really just a pragmatic reaction, a pragmatic response that I think makes them vulnerable to someone who does have a vision, who does have a sense of how to get us out of this mess. Because that's where I really look at the kind of pre-authoritarian societies, the conditions that are really fertile to having a kind of demagogue, to having a kind of a dictator or authoritarian come in and falsely promise people a solution to this mess, because the people who are defending the status quo don't have a vision, right? They don't have anything that they believe in other than, hey, what do we do to get out of this? We don't know. And I think that's what's so upsetting to a lot of people. And it's also what's driving a lot of the China conspiracy theories, that people look at where leadership is coming from. They look at where decisive action is coming from. And it's coming from the Chinese government. And I think that terrifies a lot of people, rightly so, when they wonder who's setting the agenda and who's setting the policies for how the world collectively responds to this crisis. Because in the research I've been doing, when you look at the epidemiologists, when you look at the pandemic researchers who came up with the plans, who came up with the strategies of how to respond to a virus like this, which they anticipated, none of it involved an economic shutdown, right? There was not a single emergency plan. There was not a single epidemiologist who said that the way to respond to such a crisis is to shut down society and shut down an economy. You know, their words, quote unquote, is that's evidence that there is no plan, that there was no pandemic preparedness. And so that's where I, you know, keep coming back to legitimacy and whether all these measures were necessary. Maybe they were necessary when you had no other clue as to how to deal with this.
You know, I think you've raised like a huge basket of interesting topics, and I just want to hit on a couple of them. You're referring to like the past decline and fall of civilizations, and Mark hit the one that's was just an incredible shocker in our lifetimes, those of us who were born at least in the 70s or early 80s and or earlier, is the fall of the Soviet Union, which did seem incredibly permanent at the time, to you know, even from the outside. And you know what, I haven't read the book that Mark referenced, although I'm looking forward to doing so. But it was clear from other writings of Russians in the USSR prior to the collapse was that the simulations and simulacra and facsimiles of legitimacy, no one believed them. They'd lost all their legitimacy, but there was no alternative. So everyone just kind of went along with the illusions, right? And so
do you mean
I like your reference to the.
We pretend to work and they pretend to pay us.
Kind of, and everything else. We pretend to be a superpower, and you know, and so on. And of course, a lot of people like Dmitry Orlov is established himself as a leading light in drawing and parallels between the fall of the Soviet Union and the USA. But, you know, to go back to other civilizations, and of course, the Roman Empire is the Western Roman Empire and the Eastern, they're well documented, relatively speaking. I mean, I wish we had more documentation about the Mayans or the Incas, but their collapse prior to the arrival of the Spanish, we don't know. You know, we just don't have the documentation. So we look at Rome because we have records, right? And so we noticed that, you know, Rome had these existential crises starting in the early, 150, 170, 200 AD. And they did come up with some, they managed to get some leaders, some emperors who actually did resolve the problems by requiring sacrifices from the elites, essentially, you know? And so they were able to save Rome for several hundred more years. But when that leadership failed, and then everybody was just a self-serving, aggrandizing, you know, like how much can I get for myself? And I think that's the ruling ideology of the global economy today, is maximizing my personal gain by whatever means are available, and the best means is, as we're saying, to create a front of legitimacy behind which we're pillaging and exploiting the system.
And it creates a narrative disorder. It creates a huge contrast between what you describe as the underlying logic of everyone for themselves, and there is no greater virtue than the pursuit of the self-interest, and the messaging of public health officials, which say we're all in it together. Because the only way to achieve herd immunity, the only way to achieve or manage a public health crisis like this, is to focus on the public interest, and yet it is subverted. It reminds me of a Bob Dylan line that, you know, money doesn't talk, it screams. Money doesn't talk, it swears. And I think of that a lot when I think of this narrative disorder between everyone telling us, hey, we're all in this together, and the bank still carrying on as if, no, there is no greater virtue than the self-interest. You know, and I think about it in terms of the debt that's being created right now. And I don't mean the society debt of printing money. I mean, individually, right? When you think of, you know, I've always fond of the phrase wage slavery, that most people work a job not because they want to, but because they have debts that require them. Well, right now, all the people who are furloughed from work or unemployed from work, they still got to pay rent. They still got to pay mortgage. And rather than give people, you know, true means of alleviating that, you know, banks are doing mortgage deferrals, which means you don't have to pay now, but your interest rates will go up. You're not paying down your principal. Your credit rating is being destroyed because you're not paying your loans on time. So we've actually, you know, to bring back this metaphor of the tilted scale or the tilted landscape, we're actually creating a situation right now in which the banks effectively were profiteers or pandemic profiteers when it comes to the way in which the economy is currently configured. And it only strikes me as being a situation that results in people being further in debt and therefore further compelled to do things they don't want to do, which again undermines legitimacy and undermines any notion of a social contract.
Do we still have Charles? I don't see his video at the moment.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, you're there. All right, that's okay. I'll jump in for a second.
A little bit. Yeah, please do. Talk more about hyper-normalization, which is still a difficult concept, you know, to describe, at least for me. So,
I was just looking for one of my notes. I was thinking of a blog post I wrote a long time ago about Goodhart's Law, which was when a target becomes a measure, it becomes useless, right? And so he talked about in the Soviet Union, when the quotas were set in a nail factory by weight, they would crank like 5 300-pound nails off the assembly line and go home, right? So then they said, okay, enough of that. We're going to set the quotas by number. So then they would crank out like 10 million really tiny nails off the line and they would go home. So that's kind of this idea of we're going to set these benchmarks, this framework that's essentially meaningless, really. It's just kind of like we just need someone to tick off a box and pull a lever and we can all go home, pretend that that's a job well done. And the entire society becomes like that. And I think that's where we are now. So Governor of Michigan, not to pick on her specifically, but the social distancing rules, where people, they would go into Costco or they would go into Home Depot and they couldn't buy seeds to grow food at home because those sections of the store were taped off. And even the employees would say, we can't sell you this because it's a non-essential good. But what it really was, it was, so people, The narrative around that got distilled down to the governor of Michigan has made it illegal for you to buy seeds to grow food at home. That's not what happened. What happened was they issued rules about maximum density inside a superstore, and the result of that rule was that large sections of the store were off limits. And you see this in Canada too. There's these weird rules about opening on holidays and Sundays. You walk into a Shopper's Drug Mart on Easter Sunday and like half the aisles are just taped off with police tape. This was even before coronavirus. And you're kind of like,
I need to get something on that aisle. And depending on the store, they'll say, just go get it, right? And some store, no, we can't sell you that. So, you know what? I feel like I'm not doing the greatest job articulating it, but it's just this sort of, it's this pervasive phenomena where things get taken to their illogical extremes, not logical extremes, illogical extremes. And so, yeah, we're trying to promote social distancing, but the outcome of that is that people can't increase their self-reliance by growing food at home. And it's these weird disconnects and dichotomies that to me typify that whole life. And then pretending that this is all as it should be, pretending that this is actually having a beneficial effect, we're flattening the curve, it's working, and it's like, no, it's just making everything more stupider, you know, by the second. And that's what hypernormalization is, I think.
I think it undermines the mythology of the simulation, that as people are able to see the glitches in the matrix, as it were, the ludicrous and illogical consequences, I think that's the bubble that allows the illusion to burst. I mean, you sort of alluded to it, Mark. Here in Canada right now, people are getting $800 tickets for walking into a park.
Yeah.
Right? They've closed parks because they don't want people, they don't trust that people are going to engage in social distancing. So they're handing out, near me, a kid was given a ticket because there were toys in a sandbox in a park. And he ran to go look at the toys like a child would, and his parents were issued a ticket because they weren't allowed to go into the park. And that's just stupid when you think about the impact on health that physical activity has, that people should be encouraged to do physical activity, they should be encouraged to use outdoor spaces, and we should trust them to engage in social distance. And if they don't, give them a warning. Don't give them an $800 ticket. And the same stupidity is happening with masks, that there's growing evidence that a lot of transmission of the novel coronavirus is asymptomatic, that it's people who don't have symptoms, that are walking around, and that if we were all wearing masks, that would greatly mitigate the transmission rates. But instead, we're telling people, no, don't use masks, because masks are in short supply. So we need those masks to be dedicated to health professionals and healthcare workers. But you could make your own mask. So they could distinguish. They could say, well, medical grade masks are for health workers only. But everyone else, please make your own mask and wear that mask to mitigate the spread. I mean, in the United States, in many centers, they are now saying you must wear a mask. In Boston, in New York, they're saying you must wear a mask. They will say that here in Canada sooner rather than later, but once again, it will contradict what they were saying previously and therefore undermine the credibility and legitimacy.
Yeah, let me jump in here, if I could, about this legitimacy and hypernormalization. Just make two quick points. One is, you know, in the matrix of the elites, you know, controlling everything, if there is an ideology other than self-interest, it's got to do something. We have to make it look like we're doing something and in charge. And so then they muck it up, but they have to do something. In other words, imagine somebody in a position of authority anywhere in the world actually says, you know what, we're going to have to just let everybody, you know, follow common sense here. And, you know, we have these recommendations or something like that. In other words, we're not going to do anything, you know, huge and using you got abuse of authority, and that's part of what's reducing or eroding legitimacy. Is these abuses of authority are so painfully obvious, and it's all like there's no, as Mark said, it's illogical, and yet why are we forced to do these things? Well, and because they have the power and we don't. I mean, that in itself raises a question of the legitimacy of the entire system.
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent point, because what I've been wanting to talk about, not specifically here, but in general, is the whole concept. I mean, I come from a computer programming background and a systems background. It's the whole single point of failure. So people say things like, well, Trump messed it up. Trump screwed it up, so this is happening here, or some other leader over here screwed it up. And I'm like, doesn't that mean that the system itself is like dysfunctional and and ill-constructed when it really matters what one person does or does not do. The fate of the entire civilized world relies on that. Doesn't that mean, like, if anyone with common sense or a whole society with common sense looks at that, wouldn't they say, we have to get rid of that single point of failure? I mean, that's, you know, where we come from, that's all we do. It's like, okay, who here, you know, who in the company can't afford to be hit by a bus right now? Let's make that person able to be hit by a bus as fast as possible, you know? And so...
It's a valid point, and I think the end to it, it brings it back to Charles' point about the brittle society and the brittle economy. Our entire political system is brittle. Our entire society and the way it's constructed is brittle. For me, part of the tragedies or one of the depressing aspects of this crisis that I'm still getting over is the myth of the informed citizen. I mean, where I was previous to this content to sort of say, well, yeah, there's some stupid people out there, but at least there's enough people who pay attention and who are informed and, you know, who hold the government accountable, who hold the political class accountable. And while I still believe that there are a sizable constituency who are that way, and hopefully they are joining us now and watching this video and engaging these types of conversations, the sheer level of stupidity that we've seen in response to this crisis really makes me wonder about the notion of an informed citizenry and whether in fact what we have is a deliberately misinformed citizenry, that part of the role of the traditional media, part of the role of the political class is to keep people stupid, is to keep people confused, is to keep people bewildered when it comes to the way in which they engage with society. And that's where I agree with your point, Charles, that if there is an ideology that ends this system, you know, I would refer to it as solutionism, right? It's a belief that we have all the solutions, we have exclusive domain of the solutions. Whether those solutions work or not, whether they make the problem worse or not, doesn't matter, because we are the experts and we have the exclusive supply of all the things that could be regarded as a fix. This is certainly true in terms of the technology and the worship of technology, that, you know, technology will deliver us out of this crisis. No, I mean, technology will play a role in dealing with the healthcare side of the crisis, but there are very deep political and economic dysfunctions that are driving this crisis, and technology is not going to address them, and nor is the existing elite in terms of their belief that they hold the exclusive monopoly on all those potential fixes. Instead, I have the belief that it is about participation, that it is about agency, that the more people who feel that they can make a difference in their lives, the more likely they are to be entrepreneurs, the more likely they are to be innovators, the more likely they are to be the kind of resilient community leaders who help us get through this stuff. That's, to me, the appeal of a distributed or decentralized society, is you don't have a single point of failure. Instead, you're building capacity across the economy, across the society, so that collectively we can handle anything. And I almost feel that it is these single point of failures, it is this institutional dysfunction that, you know, keeps us in this artificially constructed stupidity, when instead we could have a much more informed and a much more engaged society.
Can I jump in at this point?
Yeah, it just... Yeah, go right ahead.
No, you go ahead, Charles.
No, I was just going to comment on one of the themes I'm picking up here that we're all talking about is the disconnect and the ramping of illogic to like an extreme. And so and the use of authority to push that lever to extremes that makes no sense. And so So the examples we've talked about is, you know, the aircraft that's run by a black box that suddenly disengages and then nobody knows how to fly the plane. The oil markets, which were supposed to be, you know, somehow traded by black box, you know, robotic traders, and it's all supposed to work out and somehow connect to the real world in ways nobody understands. And so here we are. And so part of what Marc has highlighted in the Soviet Union is we create these metrics, you know, out of more or less out of thin air. And then we focus all the attention of the system of authoritarianism on that metric. And so now it's like, well, what's the COVID-19 metric? Mm-hmm. Is it to reduce the death rate? Is it to reduce the R naught? I mean, who knows? But it's like, well, what are the costs and second order effects of focusing on this one metric? And that's where the institutional intelligence has broken down. No one's even looking at that stuff, right? And now it's been politicized. You know, like if you question the complete lockdown, then you're some right wing, you know, fanatic. And it's all like, wait a minute, isn't this decision making? How has this been politicized? And that to me speaks to the feeling that this is the end times. You know, when everything has been polarized. And then you're like the enemy because you question authority. It's like, well, there you go.
Well, and Mark, let me just jump in really quick. I think, Charles, your point about the plane that's on autopilot or the oil trading that's on autopilot, social media is also now on autopilot. I mean, the extent to which there were human content moderators before this crisis, in many cases, whether Facebook, whether YouTube, whether Twitter, those people have been prevent from going to their workplace, and the algorithms and automatic content moderation tools have been dramatically expanded. And we're seeing this in terms of automatic censorship, that if you post information about COVID-19 that has been deemed to be outside of the orthodoxy, or similarly, there's been reports about if you post material critical of China on YouTube and on other social media platforms, that it's being suppressed or it's being eliminated. And it's not necessarily because of any political ideology. It's just because the algorithms are being trained to flag that kind of content. So I think we're seeing that kind of dysfunction right across the board.
My notepad here is getting more and more jumbled and crowded, and I'm never getting to my point that I wanted to say to Jesse about his thing in the last week, but I have to jump in with two that just sprang up out of what was just said. So one is, the thing I notice about our online landscape right now, and I remarked to my wife about this a while ago, is that there's no reference point. There is no objective, arbitrary reference point in an online, algorithmically driven world, in the sense that no two people see the same thing. So if someone's trying to say, like in the most stripped down example, it's like your website doesn't work. Okay, what are you seeing? Well, they're seeing something completely different from what somebody else is seeing, because the various black boxes under the hood of the website are showing different people different things, and you can't get an objective comparison of what are you looking at, what are you supposed to be seeing versus what's there, because everything is data mined and optimized and driven down so that there is no actual reference point for anything. So, and that is incredibly hard to manage. That's hard to debug. It's hard to figure out. Mm-hmm. Like in the DNS world, we have Anycast and we have GeoDNS. We're sort of, depending on where the query is coming from, we have to give out different answers, and debugging that is very difficult. And I'm saying, because the person running a query from Russia gets a different response from a person running a query from Australia, and you have to figure out where is the disconnect. And we have that to the exponent a million in our online world. So you have these automatic algorithmic censorship, for example. Our Klaviyo account got shut down when we tried to send Axis of Easy, the newsletter, 2 weeks ago, because it contained the phrase Bitcoin payments. And it wasn't like, hang on, let's have a look at this. You sure you want to do this? They nuked the account. It was just like, this account has been terminated. And it's just like, what the hell just happened, you know? And we pay these guys over, you know, $1,000 a month. It's not like it's a little BS $12 thing or something. So it was just all algorithmically generated, and it was all just sort of like on a most benign phrase that was completely devoid of context. The other thing, the myth of the informed citizen. Okay, so I struggle with this all the time. You know, as a guy who, you know, Austrian school economists, libertarian leaning, sort of like You got to just let people take self-personal responsibility, and they got to manage their own lives, and they got to deal with the consequences of their own actions. And then I just kind of throw my hands up in the air when I see what's going on in the world. I'm like, these people are too stupid to do that. You know, there has to be this patrician class of technocrats that are looking after everything just to keep these morons from tripping over their own feet and impaling themselves on a garden rake, because otherwise it'll just be bedlam. There was this great BBC series called Utopia, which, if I remember it correctly, interestingly enough, it was about a conspiracy to unleash a pandemic to which the vaccine would make most of the population sterile to depopulate the world, right? And these plucky survivors, they find clues to this conspiracy that someone hid in a comic book, and they're finding it. And I call the struggle that I'm going through Mr. Rabbit's Dilemma, because in that series, the villain behind the scenes that's trying to get these plucky survivors from spilling the beans on this global conspiracy is Mr. Rabbit. That's the code name of this person that runs this shadowy organization that is trying to run this conspiracy play on the world. And all of a sudden, like three quarters of the way through this story, Mr. Rabbit is killed, but one of the plucky survivors realizes, you know what? These people are right. And he becomes the new Mr. Rabbit. And it actually drove him insane. The cognitive dissonance drove the character insane, and he was like carving himself up with a razor blade. And I call that Mr. Rabbit's Dilemma, because you have this moral and ethical impulse to do the right thing and to fight for people's liberty and their right to self-determination. And then you see the outcomes of this, and you look at it and you go, I can't leave these people in a room with a pair of scissors, right? They just need to be like... And that's Mr. Rabbit's Dilemma, and I struggle with this on a constant basis, actually.
Although, what's interesting about the analogy you give is the way in which the individual who becomes Mr. Rabbit internalizes Mr. Rabbit's perspective. And I think that's the danger, that as we criticize the elite, we leave ourselves vulnerable to internalizing their logic, to internalizing their perspective, when instead we should be dismissing their logic and their perspective. So to your point, for me, the tragedy of the uninformed citizen, the tragedy of the disinformation or misinformation that exists, is not to accept it. It's not to say, oh, well, I guess I've realized that people are stupid, now I should just act accordingly. No, I think it's a challenge that, oh, it's just dawned upon me that people are stupid. We need to double down on fighting that stupidity. We need to look at the ways in which people are manipulated, the way in which the black box society keeps people in the dark. And that's where this entire crisis has really reinforced my belief in transparency, that what we need is more light, that what we need are not black boxes, but open systems. So that way you don't depend upon an informed citizenry, instead you depend upon an active citizenry, so that the people who are willing to inform themselves have an opportunity to act upon their knowledge, to act upon their awareness. And further, not to get, I want to say schadenfreude as a verb, but not to indulge in my own tendency towards schadenfreude, I hope the media collapse. I hope the media industry implodes. But my fear is, just like the airlines, they're going to be bailed out. And here in Canada, it kind of suggests that the private media becomes state-based media, which is even worse, where, you know, I sort of feel that the problem of the uninformed citizen is a problem of stupid media. And if we remove the subsidies that enable that stupid media, there'll be a far greater opportunity for people to actually be informed.
I got to just jump in real quick. I know, Charles, you want to say something, but to your point, Jesse, when I feel sort of overwhelmed by the stupidity, I realize what you say is right, that is a cultivated ignorance. That is a system that is deliberately trying to make people stupid I mean, I've been quoting Edward Bernays a lot this week. I mean, he wrote the handbook in 1926. He wrote three of them, actually. And world leaders have embraced that ever since. And more, as I've thought about these problems, even before this crisis started, I always come to the same conclusion. It's not the bankers necessarily. It's not big corporations. It's not even big tech. It's not even the government. It's the media. I always come back to, like, the mainstream media is actually the biggest problem that we face today because of the way they frame things and dumb it down and lowest common denominator. And now, even more perniciously, the way they marginalize, you know, they close the Overton window. And if you go out, if you color outside the lines, it's like they just, you're a racist, you're a white nationalist, you're an incel, you're a science denier. And it's just, anyway.
Thought crimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I will end my part of the conversation by just kind of trying to tie this into one last idea, which is, do the elites that we're talking about believe their own mythology? And I believe they do. And that's part of why the legitimacy of the system is failing, as there is no transparency there, except in their own minds. They think, yeah, we really got a handle on this, and we have the tools and the expertise. And so that leads to the ultimate disconnect, which I'm going to refer back to Marie Antoinette's comment, when the peasantry have no bread, well, let them eat brioche, right? Translated as cake, you know, typically in English. But, and so that disconnect of in the minds of the elites, I think that's a real issue here too. And that's when the system starts breaking down, is when that becomes visible or undeniable.
And to mix metaphors, but to, you know, say my last thing and throw it to Mark to close, it's as if the elite are getting high off their own supply. And in particular, their own supply is the monetary supply that they're getting high on. And it's part of why they don't believe their own bullshit.
Yeah. Have either of you paid much attention? This is just an anecdotal data point to support, I think, what Charles hit upon there. Have you watched George W. Bush, or George Bush, the second Bush, baby Bush, since he retired? Like, he kind of strikes me as he's gone off his rocker, right? But even beyond that, like, you see him acting erratically at public events and stuff, but even his art, if you look at his art, it's not bad. He can paint. But there's this kind of Hall of Mirrors introspection to it. Like, this is a man who's not entirely okay with the role he's played in history, and he's trying to, like, grapple with it as best he can. And that's kind of what I think. I could be reading way too much into it, but that's what your point made me think of. I think some of them believe their own BS. This morning I was having the thought, you know, I don't think Donald Trump is racist, because I think he's so narcissistic that the concept of racism to him is kind of immaterial. He's like a solipsist, where he believes that it's either my own self-awareness that fills the entire universe, or it's irrelevant. So in racism can't even fit into that construct. And so that is an elite that sort of believes his own BS and the BS of the system itself. But it's not just, I'm not talking about cartoonish populists either. I'm talking about some of these intellectuals who are, like, you know, writing the books that are the talk of the town. I don't want to name names and stuff, that are, like, you know, they almost sound contrarian when they talk, but it's sort of like, you're just really a complete bootlicking apologist for the elite technocrats that are running the system. And a lot of them really do believe their own story. I never got
not
to that
us,
point.
Though.
Not us.
We're always self-critical.
I don't believe anything. So that's my problem, right? I'm going through this complete nihilistic crisis of faith, really, where it's like, you know, it's all BS. What does it matter? You know?
I think that's the danger, though. That kind of, not nihilism, but that kind of just hopelessness is something that I do worry is part of the purpose of this pandemic, that it is designed to make people feel that they have no other options but compliance. And I think that's why it is important for critical voices to be shared and to be amplified. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Marshall McLuhan, and one of his favorite sayings that I've stolen is, I do not necessarily believe what I'm saying. And I think that we should all have that type of luxury to be able to engage in freedom of speech, to be able to engage in intellectual exercises as a way of keeping ourselves honest. And if I were to give any empathy to our current political class, it's that we do not afford them the privilege of being able to say things that they are not held accountable to. I would like to see a democratic society where leaders or political actors are permitted to float trial balloons or are permitted to play devil's advocacy just for the purpose of being a gadfly or just for the purpose of fostering wider social debate. And I think that our society is brittle and dysfunctional because of that, because we don't allow for healthy and diverse political debate. Granted, I think that they are complicit in the way in which they maintain their power, but I think moving forward that if common sense and logic are not primary characteristics of public debate, there will be no legitimacy and there will be no trust.
Excellent point. Well, we cannot indulge it focus totally on fear. We have to also look at faith, you know, in our own intelligence and in the, you know, the common sense of our fellow humans. So I'll choose faith over fear.
I mostly do too, and it's punctuated by these sort of breaks in. I mean, it's my own personal psychology. I've been racked with self-doubt my entire life. It's just kind of the way I roll. So I think I almost do it intentionally just to keep myself as honest as I, you know, am capable of. So, I thought I had another point. I think it just slipped my mind. I'm going to think that maybe this is a good place to wrap it up. I will say I'm pretty heartened by the response to the Access of Easy website so far, because I noticed people have been linking to it from a couple of discussion forums and stuff. And I've been getting emails behind the scenes from people saying that this has, you know, helped keep their, you know, that they feel they're not alone. So I think that's the other thing. I really want to build sort of a head of steam here and some momentum for people that just, you know, your phrase, Jesse, still strikes me as the best, seeing beyond the frame. Because it's the framing, I really think, that's boxing us in and keeping us, you know, restricting our genuinely adaptive ways of reacting to this situation.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So
I think that's a great point to end on.
Thanks. Okay. Yeah, let's excellent. Wrap it there, and let's hope like crazy that we got it. Yeah.